Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about TechTent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to TechTent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catherine-Jones, and this week I'm joined from the BBC online tech desk by Chris Fox. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Good to see you again. And my special guest this week is the technology writer and robotics researcher Adriana Hammaker. We'll be chatting to her about how humans interact with robots and more besides. Hello, Adriana.
Hi, Rory.
Here's a quick taste of what's coming up.
At a time when some people wonder if there is no more room for smartphone innovation, our belief in meaningful progress is stronger than ever.
If you're big, if you're successful, if you become dominant, no matter your origin, if you do something that you shouldn't, we will start looking.
Stay with us for all that and more. But first this week...
We changed the way that we store data. We changed the way that we communicate data. We went to entirely secure connections on all of Yahoo's major properties, HTTPS. We changed the way we did encryption between the data centers to basically get a more secure environment for our end users, because we realized that that's what they wanted.
Well, that's Yahoo's chief executive, Marissa Mayer, speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos last year, all about how her company's beefed up security measures. That was in response to cyber threats at that time and allegations of US government snooping. But now Yahoo has admitted that up to 500 million of its users may have had their details stolen in what they're calling a state-sponsored hack. Our man in Silicon Valley, Dave Lee, has been up all night, all day, following developments. Dave, just take us through exactly what Yahoo has said about this attack, which it says happened actually in 2014, doesn't it?
Yeah, so Yahoo put out a statement from their chief information security officer, a guy called Bob Lord, and he explained that they were hacked in 2014 and that they discovered the breach when it was investigating a rumoured hack that was reported by Vice News. They were looking into that, and at first they were worried that 200 million people were hacked, but when they were looking into that, they found that wasn't the case for that one. But actually, what they did find was something much, much worse, a hack that, as you mentioned, hit 500 million people, and things like names, addresses, dates of birth, they were all stolen, as were security questions and answers. So things like when you log on, or if you forget your password and it says, you know, what was your mother's maiden name? The questions and answers to those things have been taken, but not credit card data, they said, which is pretty important. And also the passwords were encrypted with what experts are describing as sort of moderately good encryption. So it's not devastating the type of information, but the sheer scale of how many people are affected is absolutely unprecedented.
Yeah, and when what people are talking about is how long ago this happened, why they took so long to find it out. And of course, the timing is terrible, because Yahoo's actually been sold to the communications giant Verizon a couple of months ago, but that deal hasn't gone through yet. So what are Verizon saying?
Well, Verizon, they said they only found out about the hack within the past 2 days, which is quite staggering when you think about it, because we're assuming that Yahoo were investigating this for longer than that. So Verizon perhaps are quite angry. They said they're evaluating their own interests, which reading between the lines, they'll probably look at this and go, wow, is it worth it? Is it worth buying this? Because if Yahoo faces... they're going to face investigations by regulators, but if they face a lawsuit as well, a class action lawsuit, the damages to that could be huge, and therefore Verizon might be looking at this deal and saying, is it worth it? Are we going to get our money's worth for spending $4.8 billion on this? Many people are suggesting that they'll still want to buy Yahoo because they'll still get the users they were after in that deal, but the price may come down.
That would be interesting. How does this rank briefly against other big hacks? We've covered a lot of big hacks on this program.
It knocks them out of the park. It's a record Yahoo never would have wanted. And we've seen some big hacks recently. MySpace, 359 million users. LinkedIn, a very damaging hack, 164 million. And Adobe was hacked as well for 152 million users. This puts those well aside, 500 million. So, yeah, it's a big, big deal, and one for the record books, unfortunately.
Not a record that Yahoo will be wanting to claim. Thanks, Dave. Well, our online desk editor Leo Kellyan, he's been asking the renowned computer security consultant Troy Hunt, the man behind the Have I Been Pwned website, how worried Yahoo users should be about this news.
Look, I think for the average user, we've got to remember this happened 2 years ago. So, yeah, we've got 2 years worth of that data having been obtained by someone else. I wouldn't be sort of as concerned as some of the other incidents where the data was floating around very publicly between data breach traders, hacktivists, if this is actually state-sponsored as is being reported. Governments are generally a little bit less likely to put their data up on the web and share it with their mates in a pretty public way.
So if people have put sensitive things in their Yahoo email, though, should they have to assume that maybe that might have been looked at, or is that overreacting?
Well, certainly it's a possibility. Look, the reality of it is Yahoo accounts are hacked every single day because of other bad practices as well, things like weak passwords, which the majority of people have, reused passwords, which the majority of people have, lack of multi-factor authentication, which most accounts don't have turned on. In terms of this particular incident, it's going to be very dependent on how the passwords were stored, so how good a job did Yahoo do of cryptographically storing them. And it will come back down to the strength of the credentials that people made as well. So unfortunately, for the average person, that generally isn't too good.
This hack seemingly happened in 2014. It's only being announced now. How surprising is it that there's been such a big gap?
It's become a little bit of a trend lately because we've seen things like MySpace happen even earlier than that. In fact, we believe MySpace was probably more around 2010. LinkedIn was 2012. Even Dropbox, which was released recently, that the data was released, that was also 2012. So this sort of trend of seeing very large data breaches from some time ago only popping up years later is something that's been happening a little bit in 2016. The thing that does appear to be somewhat different about this one, though, is the claims of it being state-sponsored. So we're sort of, it'll be interesting to see how that one actually plays out yet.
How might they know? I know there's other people who are kind of having a bit of skepticism about that. How might they know that it's state-sponsored? It's not presumably like anyone leaves a calling card.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. If we look at other sort of state-sponsored attacks, sometimes when we see attacks such as we've seen with the Iranian government on certificate authorities before, we had evidence of particularly a lot of malicious activity coming from Iran and a lot of odd behaviour coming from Iran, so you can sort of tie it down to geolocation. We've seen other state-sponsored attacks, things like the Sony Pictures hack a couple of years ago, which was a very vocal, very, very loud attack, although the attribution of it being North Korea wasn't particularly clear. The investigators managed to tie it together by looking at things like server logs. So where have these attacks been coming from? By looking at things like what are the tradecraft of the attackers? What are the general sort of patterns that they use to break into a system? So there's always some degree of a paper trail. And inevitably, there's been enough for Yahoo to attribute it to some state sponsor. It'll be interesting to see if they actually name a state.
That's the security researcher Troy Hunt talking to our Leo Kellyan. Now, have a listen to this.
At a time when some people wonder if there is no more room for smartphone innovation, our belief in meaningful progress is stronger than ever. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce the Samsung Galaxy Note 7.
Now, of course, the world's most advanced mobile operating system deserves the most advanced smartphone. And here it is. It's the best iPhone that we have ever created. This is iPhone 7.
Well, two typically hysterical mobile phone launches. That was Samsung's DJ Ko and Apple's Tim Cook in recent weeks launching their latest smartphones. But are they managing to keep customers interested? The consulting firm Deloitte brings out a big annual survey of the mobile consumer. And Paul Lee from Deloitte is the mastermind behind it. He's with us. Paul, I get the feeling that we might have reached peak smartphone. Is the innovation over? Can they do anything more with these extraordinary devices?
I mean, I think what's certain is phones do look very similar year on year, but what's going on underneath the hood keeps on changing. And overall, they're still convincing 1.5 billion people worldwide to buy a new phone every single year. So it's still working. And there's things like faster processors, better battery management. There's new features like fingerprint readers didn't really exist 3 years ago, which would really help with things like passwords. And in the UK alone, we estimate that these sensors are being used over 100 billion times by UK consumers alone.
So what's the biggest single innovation that we could see yet in smartphones?
Well, one of the big ones is always going to be faster speed. And the fastest networks globally now are running at half a gigabit per second to a mobile phone. In the UK, you get up to over 300 megabits per second. And as you get faster and faster networks connecting to phones, we find new ways to use all of that speed. So the idea of, you know, live streaming the news via your mobile phone, it's not just about what you receive, but also what you can send. And I think we will find ways to use up all that extra capability, those extra speed, and use up all that capacity on these phones.
So network capability is very important for how they develop. Now, we've seen all these companies looking desperately for the next trend, all the big technology companies. They've been looking at wearables, the huge craze around virtual reality, the Internet of Things. Are any of those going to be the sort of mass market, huge transformative technologies that smartphones have been?
They all may be. At the moment, it doesn't look like it. And when you look at the sales of VR and TV sets, tablets, PCs, all of that put together is still less than the amount of money which smartphones generate or the number of units which they sell in. And, you know, if VR has a year it's expected to, we'd expect it to do about $1 billion, which would be less than 1% of, so it'd be about 1/3% of smartphone revenues.
So a tiny fraction of what smartphones earn the industry. Let's bring in Adriana Hammaker, our special guest, technology writer, robot specialist. Are you still excited by what smartphones are doing, or are you more excited by these other technologies that Paulie says aren't really taking off yet?
Well, I welcome the fact that the new smartphones are waterproof. I think that's good, even though there's no guarantee. So that's one thing that's brilliant. But there are also things like dual cameras being introduced by Apple. And that, for instance, could open up the door to augmented reality. Pokemon Go has been such a massive phenomenon, especially among younger people, that's surely a really good way to go. They're looking for innovations in all sorts of things, and smartphones are likely to be controllers for the Internet of Things. Even though the Internet of Things isn't quite there yet, the features are still being developed now.
And a quick word from Chris Fox from the BBC Tech Desk. You, I know, are a very keen smartphone user. You're the only remaining BlackBerry user.
Oh.
Are you still into innovation?
I think so. There's always new little tricks. Even with a BlackBerry, they're making the keyboards touch sensitive, which is a new innovation on an older idea. All I want, though, is a battery that lasts all day. And even the new iPhone 7 hasn't got that.
And so say all of us. The battery is, that's the key issue for all of us. You're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service. I'm Rory Catherine-Jones. In a moment, why a code of ethics may be needed for robots. But first, let's have a look at some of the week's other big tech stories with Chris Fox. Last week on this programme, we had a lively interview with Gary Shapiro from the US Consumer Technology Association, who told us that Europe was targeting American firms over issues like tax because his own companies simply couldn't compete, couldn't hack it. Well, this week, the European Union's Competition Commissioner has hit back at her critics. Chris, what's she been saying?
Yeah, Margarita Vestager was on a 3-day trip to the US to meet lawmakers and policymakers there and to defend the EU's decision to order Apple to pay the Irish government those €13 billion in back taxes in the state aid case. The EU is also investigating Google over competition complaints. The commissioner told the BBC she rejects the idea that there's a protectionist bent to the EU's investigations.
Well, actually, no. I can't see that. If you're big, if you're successful, if you become dominant, no matter your origin, if you do something that you shouldn't, we will start looking. And in a number of these cases, you find as many US complainants as European complainants.
That's Margarita Vestager. And Facebook's founder Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan, they've outlined a plan to use their billions to fund medical research, and they've got an extraordinary ambition.
Certainly is a big ambition. They've said their ultimate goal is to cure, prevent or manage all diseases by the end of the century. They said that at a press conference in San Francisco. It is a big challenge, but Mark Zuckerberg is at least aware of the challenge ahead.
It's going to take years before the first tools get built, and then years after that before they're actually used to cure diseases. So we have to be patient. This is hard stuff, but it's important. And, you know, I think that this is about the future that we all want for our children, right? Because if there's even a chance that we can help to cure all diseases in our children's lifetime, that our children or even their children can live happier, healthier lives, then we're going to do our part.
It's certainly a big ambition. He's going to spend $3 billion over 10 years. It's worth pointing out other companies do spend more. The Wellcome Trust is the world's biggest medical research charity. They spend $6.5 billion over the next 5 years. And the US National Institutes of Health spend a whopping $32 billion every year in research. But it's still an honourable ambition.
Yeah, absolutely. But not all good news for Facebook's founder. The company's been accused of miscalculating miscalculating how long people watch videos.
Yes, Facebook loves to boast how many people are now watching videos on its platform, but it's admitted in a blog post that it's been working out the average watch time of videos incorrectly. That's when it says things like, people watched this video for an average of 20 seconds. It had been excluding people who watched for less than 3 seconds. And as you can imagine, if you include people who switched off within 3 seconds, you would bring those average watch times right down. They're now going to have a more accurate way of calculating it. They've said it's been fixed and it didn't affect how advertisers were charged, but I'm sure advertisers weren't happy about it.
You know, already seeing some rumblings from advertisers, and there was a concern that could actually hit Facebook's extraordinary profits. Now, regular listeners might recall this guy.
Do you like a bottle of wine of an evening? A glass of wine, maybe?
I'm afraid of the dark. They say there are robot ghosts who walk around, rattling chains and turning the PCs on and off.
Well, that was me earlier this year, speaking to Promobot, a Russian-built service robot, the kind expected to enter our homes and workplaces in the not-too-distant future. Well, this week, the British Standards Institution, the body here in the UK that produces technical standards for products and services, unveiled a standard on robot ethics. It's BS8611. If you want to look it up, though, I think it's going to cost you about $200 to actually buy the document. I asked Dr. Stephen Cameron from Oxford University, who chaired the whole process, why an official standard for robot behaviour was needed.
The idea of the standard comes from the fact that robotics are becoming ubiquitous, and we have several possible uses coming up where robots might just cause problems in an ethical manner. Unless people think about it first. And one thing about robots is that they might, for example, be used in the home to look after the elderly. And there you have to make sure that the security and privacy is taken care of, and that you also don't want people thinking of robots as being human, and maybe the designers then being able to take advantage of the users in that way.
Why don't we want to see robots as human? Surely that's what a lot of robot design is about, almost to fool us into thinking they're real people.
Well, there are some reasons why you might want to do that, but there are also good reasons sometimes why you might not.
Is it physical robots that you're more concerned about, or is it the general question of intelligent software invading ever more areas of our lives?
Well, the committee that I chair deals with robotics, so we were definitely thinking about robots when we wrote the standard. But a lot of the issues that come up in the standard do apply to other devices that have no moving parts.
That's Dr. Stephen Cameron from Oxford University with his robot ethics code. Our special guest, Adriana Hammerkirk, has been conducting her own experiment at University College London on how people treat robots who appear to display emotions. Adriana, explain what you were looking for and what you found.
Well, we wanted to compare a number of conditions in one robot. So we looked at expressiveness, communication, and we contrasted that with sort of better efficiency. So the robot that was more expressive made mistakes, but that didn't seem to bother people too much because they really enjoyed interacting with this robot. It was, by the way, Bert at Bristol Robotics Laboratory. That was the robot's name, Bert.
So describe what Bert looks like. Is Bert meant to look almost human, and does that matter?
Well, some people don't like robots to look too human, and it's very cultural as well. For instance, the Japanese quite like that, but most people think that it's a bit spooky. They refer to things such as the uncanny valley if a robot looks too human. So Bert was probably a bit more like a cartoon character, exaggerated features, kind of cute looking in some ways, trying not to be threatening, but definitely not too human-like.
It's strange though, isn't it? We want these robots to perform tasks for us, and some things that you could define as a robot, like that Amazon Echo speaker that we had in the studio last week. Of course, they don't look at all like a human, but they do a job. Is there a desire, though, to put a face on things that, frankly, don't need a face?
Well, I think it certainly helps because people respond brilliantly to robots that are a bit more like themselves. I mean, they're almost looking for human-like traits. It's called anthropomorphizing something. Obviously, this is better for some people respond better than others. Some people are more prone to speak to their cat or their car. Others don't. There's some research came out quite recently that says that robots don't need to look human-like. But I found in the study that I did that it definitely helped.
Paul Lee from Deloitte, let's just bring you in on this. What's your take on what kind of robots are likely to take off from your research?
What we're seeing when it comes to robots in general, they are being brought in to do a specific task. So, you know, car manufacturer is a very good example of that.
And they don't need a human face.
They don't need a human face. They need to do one job which humans can't do. And it's when they do jobs which humans are not very good at. So in terms of strength or precision or repetitiveness, that's where they come in. So the notion of having robots delivering pizzas, I think, is a great story, but it's not very likely because they go too slowly and run out of battery, etc.
But what about the human side of them? I mean, in some cases, we do want them to be almost human, don't we?
I think we tend to relate to technology which does a job quickly and efficiently. So, you know, this whole thing around, do we want to have conversational bots in instant messaging, or do we want to just have apps which do things? And I came across this perfect app which orders pizza in 10 seconds. So you open the app, and if you don't do anything after 10 seconds, it orders your regular pizza, delivers it to your regular address, uses your regular credit card. Ideal.
Well, we're all going to have to interact with efficient humanoid robots or much simpler versions. Sadly, we've run out of time once again. Thanks to my guests, Adriana Hammaker and Paul Lee, and to our reporter Chris Fox from the BBC Online Tech Desk. Watch his work at bbc.com/technology. Keep in touch with us on Facebook and Twitter, and join me in the tech tent at the same time next week.